and I'm privileged to be Bristolian.
Man huddled in this darkness, fearful, trembling, cold, hungry. And around about he could hear the beasts roaring, and sometimes they were roaring because they were after him, and sometimes he was eaten. A man eventually saw another tree struck by lightning and grabbed that branch with that flame on it, and by a little experimentation he learned how to keep that fire going. And if he could keep the fire going, he knew something nobody else knew, and he became the first king, the first priest, the first scientist, all rolled into one.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with me, Tony Gosling. Falkland's hero, Lord Carrington, departs this mortal coil, but we haven't heard much about his role in World War II, prolonging it by 4 months, or as chairman of Bilderberg. In the UK press, not a single obituary I could find mentioned that Carrington was the chairman of Bilderberg for several years in the 1990s. It's only the most powerful gang in the Western world. Better keep that off the historical record, eh? And so how did it go with Trump at NATO? Well, apparently the US is fed up with paying 80% of the cost of NATO, unless the European member countries double their contribution from 2% of GDP to 4% of GDP, then they might just pull their troops and their contribution out of NATO and leave. Well, bring it on. The UK has thousands of US troops here, and a score or so of military bases. Some say the only purpose they're serving is to make Britain a target of Russian or maybe even Chinese ballistic missiles. Anyway, with me this evening is Bob Nichols from Bristol Against the Arms Trade, who's organised a walk and picnic on Sunday, taking in some lovely urban countryside and some of Bristol's two dozen or so arms companies. You know, the ones who are supplying weapons to kill innocent civilians in illegal wars in Palestine and Yemen, for example. And those companies who, while they're about it, are lobbying for war. Because, yes, some people do want a war. Some people make a lot of money. Also, the Israeli settlement program. We go to Gaza to take a look at the real reasons Israelis go to live there. And it's not just because they're surrounded by soldiers, and if any unarmed Palestinians walk anywhere nearby, they're liable to get shot dead. And also, we're going to have a go at getting to the heart of the matter. Where does it say in the Bible that Benjamin Netanyahu should behave like this, with his soldiers killing unarmed civilians? And if so many secular Jews, including Syrian politicians and military men, don't believe in God, then who promised them this land, if God didn't? Our sister show Dialects, back on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. Catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk. This week we'll be hearing from Gilad Atzmon, the jazz musician. He's very controversial. Some people call him anti-Semitic, but I've had a good look at what he's said, and actually he's been misquoted every time. And he'll be talking about all sorts of things, and we're going to hear a clip from him later, including the whole controversy within the Labour Party, but also as someone who was born in Israel, talking about the whether or not Benjamin Netanyahu and the Likud party are following the the expression of God and what God is telling them to do in the Bible, which of course they're not. But anyway, Bob Nichols, we'll be talking about that a bit later. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Good evening.
Hi. Now, you're doing a walk, I understand. Maybe you should just start by saying what Bristol Against the Arms Trade is and what it's really all about. It sounds pretty obvious, but do we have much of an arms trade here?
Bristol has a very long history of producing aircraft, mainly for military use, since probably before the in between the wars. I think they're producing airplanes for the First World War, and that's developed over and over the years into one of the largest conglomerations of aerospace high-tech industry in Europe.
I mean, if Airbus pull out, as they keep threatening to do, is that going to be good from your point of view?
Well, it's only relocating in terms of like a campaigner who's against the arms trade. It doesn't make any difference. I mean, I don't particularly want to see highly skilled people unemployed. That's not the goal of us as campaigners. That we would have another approach of, as arms conversion, as it were, really.
What does that mean?
There is a renaissance amongst, and there's been a proposition, or what they call it, within the Labour Party to consider arms conversion in high-tech industries that are producing military things, and based on the Lucas Aerospace plan 20 or 30 years ago, and which under these circumstances 30 years ago, a manufacturer the workers came up with a plan because they thought they were all going to be laid off, to come up with different ways of using their skills to produce things more socially useful within society. So that, I think that's what we would love to see, really.
Now, you know what that reminds me of?
Go on.
Concorde. Because all of the skills that have been built up during World War II, after World War II in the 50s and 60s, were crystallised into something which didn't drop bombs and didn't fire missiles. So is that what you're trying to say? I mean, is that the sort of thing you're talking
well,
about?
Well, there's an argument against aircraft that are actually polluting and use vast amounts of energy. I mean, the Lucas Aerospace plan, I think they came up with about 300 from wind turbines, which in those days were quite high tech and really were very small scale. And that has, I mean, it's just gone on to prove, really, that if we did really put some money into that, we could, be world leaders.
So,
really.
So you're saying you don't want any aeroplanes at all? Not even the Airbus that we go on holiday on, EasyJet or whatever on?
Well, that's my own personal view. Well, I haven't flown. Well, I've flown once in an aeroplane to Edinburgh in 10 years, and I'm against the actual profligate use of oil, really. And airplanes are terrible for that. They're very polluting. I think it'll bite us back, really, in terms of pollution and energy use.
But the only thing is, Bob, I mean, practically speaking, if you're working 24/7, all the hours God sends, and you get yourself a week off, you actually do want to get on an aeroplane and go somewhere nice and warm for that week and then come back. Surely the main real polluters are the business users of jets, not the whole people who go off, you know, maybe once a year on their holiday. Because quite often they could probably just have a Skype call with somebody, you know, rather than zip about as they do through Bristol Airport here and many other airports. It's the business users.
I think in a way you're right. I mean, why shouldn't somebody who's worked hard go off and have a holiday? But it's actually when you have there's a very very generous tax dispensation on airplane fuel, and actually it makes it ridiculously cheap, really, for people to go off and have, like, get drunk in Croatia, you know, for celebrate their mate's marriage or something, or other ridiculous, you know, pub darts team day out, or even myself, and I have to like own up to that, going off to Edinburgh to the Christmas sales. That is ridiculous. Why fly? I could go to Bristol. I could do it cheaply because, you know, the state or whatever, the tax system is subsidising that. I don't know quite why.
Well, I'll continue one of the reasons, and that's because when these aircraft can fly from country to country so easily, as they do, then it's quite difficult for one government to then say, we're going to have very expensive... I mean, imagine if you were driving your car like you would an aircraft all over the world, you would probably fuel up in the places where the fuel was cheapest.
Yes, that's, I can't argue against that. So that's probably, yeah, it's very. It'll be very difficult to regulate. You can't
As soon as you start putting big taxes on the airline fuel, you're going to find
go somewhere
people
else,
will
yes,
be buying it somewhere else. This is where things like the EU come in, isn't it? Where actually, if you've got a big organiser, maybe they go to Iceland and they fuel up there, or Norway that's outside the EU. Anyway, look, tell us what you're up to on Sunday.
Sunday, it's an awareness-raising walk, starting off at University of the West of England.
The weather's looking good, by the way.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant. We had good... I think we've had one or two... We definitely won this year, if not two. They're quite long walks, but you can try and join us in on the way or... leave as
now
you can.
Now, you're getting me nervous now. How long is quite long? 10 miles?
You're walking from Uwey towards the big roundabout at the end of the Gloucester Road, so that's up by where Airbus is. It's quite manageable, really.
How many miles?
But in hot weather, you need to have a hat. It was very hot the last time. And some water.
How far are we talking about? How long in terms of time?
Oh, it'll be a couple of hours, yeah.
Okay, well, that's not too bad, is it?
Yeah.
That sounds like a mile.
No.
Well, a couple of miles, maybe. All right. So, where are you actually going? So, you can name us some of the arms firms that are here. This is what I'd be fascinated to hear: is what arms companies do we have here in Bristol?
Well, there's different layers of it, and it's been an interesting journey for me as well to find out how much is around as we were investigating this at a bit more depth, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and. The walk starts at Uwey. Now, why significance of universities? They get paid by the military or government for high tech research. Really, the initial sort of research for do military thing. Robotics is a good example. So Bristol and Uwey are involved in that. And then the walk progresses just over the road to the business park owned by Uwey, and. Surprise, surprise, we were over there campaigning against Raytheon, missile manufacturer, and then we explored, and there's all these other arms companies based there, using them as offices mainly. And why that is, because the other side of University of West of England is the sort of defence procurement site, well known around Bristol, and which is a honeypot for big companies to promote their military... projects, really, because the armed services buy, usually it's when they have a they're multi-million pound projects. So there's a lot of companies, I should think, about at least 12 to 15 around the business park, producing different things, because they might be the new aircraft carriers or the frigates or the new troop carriers or the airplanes or whatever.
No, I think it's fair to say that nobody really minds you building weapons when they're actually genuinely for defence against other countries that might be about to invade you or attack you, like in the Second World War. You know, we got into a bit of a scrap with the Nazis and we did have to start building a lot of airplanes, then we fought the Battle of Britain, that sort of thing.
Yes.
And there is a definite sense of right and wrong sometimes in wartime as to who's right and who's wrong. And sometimes you have to make a stand. I mean, I'm not saying necessarily that what Britain did in World War II was 100% right. Maybe there were mistakes that we made. But at the end of the day, the sort of rule that the Nazis were bringing out across occupied Europe and the mass extermination of communists, trade unionists, Jews, gypsies, all these types of people, wasn't really the sort of... well, we wanted to live in, was it? And so at that point, you do wonder, I mean, would you still try to defend the stopping of the arms trade in that kind of circumstance where we're fighting the fascist enemy?
I think it's the point of the walk is actually to raise awareness that there's a sort of creeping militarisation within society. I mean, to answer your question, your initial, is about are not all wars are just, and parallel with that, I think, is we all at an individual level, and maybe as a society, and maybe even as a European bloc, have the right to self-defence. So, you know, if somebody was attacking me, I'd feel quite, you know, I thought it would be okay, maybe to pick something up and I'd bash them back. And so I'm not personally a pacifist, and I don't think our group is, but it's the same as you were speaking earlier about the issue of homes. It's actually being driven by corporations who want to make lots of money, and we could have quite an effective defence, but it doesn't have to be aggressive in terms of like expansive and wanting to take territory, which we did as a country in the sort of delayed days of colonialism. We could have an effective defence, but it doesn't have to be. It could be less, a lot less than to expand our defences would be ridiculous.
We are taking actually quite a major role in the war in Yemen at the moment, which has been classed as the most horrendous. I think it's several agencies, including the UN, saying this is the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet at the moment, where effectively you've got the Saudi Arabian military equipped and helped by the Royal Air Force and equipped with British aircraft, equipped with British munitions,
yes,
dropping bombs on people. Now,
that's correct.
I remember around about 18 months ago reading a report, a UN report. Was it the UN, or it was maybe one of the major news agencies, saying that there were no military targets left in Yemen. So one wonders what this equipment is being used for.
I'm not exactly sure what's happening, but I guess, as in when the Israelis attacked Gaza, that actually what they do is destroy all the infrastructure, hospitals, which I think are being targeted, you know, in the more granaries, which hold transport infrastructure, things like water. I think they all get destroyed. So that's what, which is. The groups that have arms out in Yemen are.
What I'm saying, I suppose, is something's changed. I always feel like the Royal Air Force now is a bit like the Luftwaffe was in Nazi Germany. You know, it's an aggressive force. It's going out to foreign countries and bombing people, often innocent people, often not military targets, and. You know, there's a sort of switch happened, a change has happened, which hasn't. It's almost as if we're supposed to still. We've had the, you know, the 70th anniversary of the Royal Air Force, I think, or was it 100th anniversary of the Royal Air Force this week. A big flypass in London. We're all supposed, yes, to be there clapping and cheering. The only thing is, these aircraft are not necessarily RAF ones particularly, but RAF personnel are being used to help with targeting in Yemen, and that targeting cannot really anymore be military, and we've also heard that the kind of targeting that's been going on has led to the biggest cholera outbreak in modern history.
Yes,
so
that's correct.
We're not really, it doesn't seem to me anymore, doing this for a positive purpose. Something's missing.
It needs a little clarification, because what we've been arming Saudi Arabia, who's so oil rich, for decades, and they haven't really done much with the planes we've been selling them. So maybe one of the princes has decided, you know, whatever, they've gone across their border and they're bombing Yemen because they feel they're a threat, I presume. That's it. So, and indirectly, we're obviously supplying the planes themselves, is what we do. We do supply the missiles, definitely, because they need particular missiles fit to certain platform, as it were, the type of plane that we have sold to the Saudi Arabians. So it's not our pilots are there. But we do train them as well in Bristol. There's a training centre that's pretty local. It's one of the few places where there's sort of armed security, really, which I presume actually the Saudi pilots would come over and do their an element of training there for our...
Where's to use that?
It's in Bradley Stoke somewhere. But I do know.
Is that part of your walk or not? Is it a bit out of your...
No, it'd just get a ridiculously large walk. We've got a map, and it's on the WordPress website, and that's quite interesting to see. Well, the about 50
I'll put a link
companies.
Up to that, the map up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, yes. And a link to your site. So what about drones? This is the modern thing, isn't it? And you know what bothers me most about drones is I think as the wars get more and more unjust and appalling, with the military being used to kill civilians, basically taking out poor countries. Yemen is the poorest country in the Middle East. And these wars become more like massacres.
Yes.
A lot of the military people actually find that they don't find it very palatable to kill people like this. And so the drone is a fantastic way of just getting it one step removed from the actual process of killing people in a so-called war, which is really probably better called a slaughter. If we got much going on in the way of drones around Bristol?
They don't actually make the drones in Bristol, but BAE Systems have a one of their research sites is in North Bristol, and you can never be quite sure what they're doing, but they will be involved in the war. And they were developing a drone they were going to try and sell, because it is big business, and it's the new form of firing, as a platform. It's a lot cheaper than having a plane that costs 60 million for each plane, to have a drone and use that. And we know that, again, missiles are designed that will go onto drones up at next door to BAE Systems at MBDA, and they are 100% missile manufacturers, and they're making a lot of money at the moment on what's going on in Yemen, because the missiles that go onto planes that we've sold to the Saudis. One thing about the Saudis don't have drones, to the best of my knowledge, so they're blasting away with the planes they've got there. So they're a step behind a lot of other countries in sort of their what they've got available to use. So it's a much more clumsy way of using these missiles. They're just still terrible things.
Well, if you look up the drone training school, yes, in Wales, won't find what you're expecting, because we had an incident last month with a Watchkeeper drone which crashed just outside a primary school. I don't know quite why the military were flying this thing on a test mission over the top of a school, but £1 million, and I'll put a link up to this on our show page too, £1 million military drone flew over a packed primary school sports day, and then everyone heard a crash. Watchkeeper drone crash was the fifth to hit the troubled development project, and it has led alarmed villagers in Penn Park, West Wales, to demand the Ministry of Defence change the flight paths of these unmanned aircraft. So the camera pans upwards, and it's a great little film. I'll definitely put this up on the internet for folks. The camera pans upward to reveal at least £1 million worth of British military hardware, a Watchkeeper drone, still in its test and development phase, flying over a packed primary school sports day attended by 100 children and a similar number of adults. The same afternoon, the drone flew over Penn Park School on another almost identical Watchkeeper crash just a couple of miles away from the village primary school, in the process narrowly missing a 70-year-old boy who was having his first driving lesson.
Was this a local one, Tony? Or this is in Wales?
This is in Wales.
Oh, yeah. Right, yes.
Journalist here from the independent newspaper is saying, the Defence Watchers, the crash will raise further doubts about the wisdom of the Watchkeeper programme. Now, again, apparently it's cost £1 billion altogether, and these these things just don't seem to work. They keep crashing.
I was very knowledgeable about the drones maybe a couple of years ago. And there are only two test sites in the UK for testing drones. But Salisbury Plain and the area around, I think it's Perranporth or something. I can't remember.
Penn Park, it says here.
Penn Park. Okay, I've made it. I think it's an old Air Force base.
All I'll say is, yeah, if you live in one of the villages around Salisbury Plain, as some of my friends do, you better watch out for these things, because they clearly keep crashing. They haven't quite got it right. And they should be keeping them away from primary schools. But look, to get back to the main issue, we're also, Abbey Wood is massive, isn't it? It's
yes.
The big MOD procurement. Last time I spoke to the journalist Mark Leftley about this, they were in a process of actually privatising it, which I could not quite believe, that a US arms company could actually run the procurement programme for the Ministry of Defence. Now, do you know to what extent that's being privatised? Is it being privatised, Abbey Wood?
Well, it does sound ridiculous, but it, I suppose at many levels that's quite possible, because a lot of it is like infrastructure, so a lot of it can be, and I can't remember if it's Balfour Beatty or one of those big companies who have international, are going to take over and run the
Could
whole...
Could it be Carillion, Barney Charles?
Well, that's I think the company's just like the Golden Goose.
Actually, Carillion did lose money. Have a contract to build some MOD stuff up there, I believe. But anyway, no, it looks as if that was scrapped. That, I mean, I'm not sure. This is under the Cameron government, the plans for the Ministry of Defence procurement to be privatised. I mean, it just sounds incredible.
They could part do it, because obviously there's things like cleaners, and then there's security, and then there's managing the building. Obviously, a lot of the employees there are actually employed by the MOD, so they'd never be employed by a private company. Why it fell through, I don't know, because it would be... maybe it was a political decision, really, rather than practical.
Well, just digging up one of the most recent articles about it, the Ministry of Defence wasted £33 million on various botched attempts to privatise procurement, a report claims, and the benefits outweighed the issues, apparently. And this is again, it's Mark Leftley, good old Mark, the Ministry of Defence. He said the MOD, and this is back in 2015, wasted £33 million of our money on botched attempts to semi-privatise the £14 billion budget agency that buys military equipment, according to a report published by the National Audit Office. So they've stepped in, rather like they did last week with Universal Credit, and criticising Esther McVeigh, the Work and Pensions Secretary, saying, look, what are you doing? You're actually just throwing this money away. So Abbey Wood is quite an important site, isn't it, nationally?
Yes, it's before Abbey Wood, each of the services had their own site. The Navy were over in Bath. I don't know where the Army was, or Air Force. And they made sense to put them all on one site, have a modern building. And so all these employees that are doing... Well, I mean, part of it is like actually just buying basic things, boots, say, for example, for soldiers. But also, it's the very high tech which draws the big companies there, really, for weapons, really, or weapons delivery, or whatever you like to call it, which are very, very costly. They involve lots of money, and they... design. There's quite a lot. Obviously, private contractors have to design them, really, or they work with the industry. The military will set a specification, say, okay, we want a tank that does this and that, and has a certain turret, and then the private company will go off and design and come up with certain products, and they compete for that. That's it. That's why there's so many people there. And an awful lot happens there in development of weapons.
Is it a site that's expanding? Isn't it, like I said, there was a Carillion contract up there a few years ago. Do you know?
I'm not exactly sure. I thought it had shrunk maybe a couple of years ago, and we're just I don't know why, but sometimes these things spread out. There's another a bit of an overlap with the University of West of England, a sort of conference, a sort of robotics centre, which is in a nearby building. So that links in with drones.
Before we get on to some clips, we're going to listen to a few clips in a minute to do with Trump and things like that. Just remind us, whereabouts is your whereabouts are you setting off from on your picnic on Sunday?
Right, it starts at 11 a.m. at the bus stops on the University of West of England French A campus. So that's the main entrance where there's a roundabout.
So you can get glorious metro bus up there, I guess, can you?
I think you can now, can you? I've never used it yet, so... But so, yeah, so the start... Or some people are meeting in the centre at the bottom of Christmas Steps to catch the 70 or 71 bus up to Uwey. That's at 10 a.m.
Are they boycotting metro bus?
I don't know how they...
maybe there's some parts on it from one of these arms firms. Anyway, look, the time is starting at UE is what?
11 a.m.
Okay.
On Sunday.
And where exactly at UE?
At the bus stops that students use. It's at the main entrance.
Okay. And you reckon it's going to go on how long?
It'd be at least a couple of hours. My colleague likes to talk a lot, and it is fascinating. He's an ex teacher, very knowledgeable, and will have some fun and learn loads.
Are there any pubs along the way? That's why
there's one at the end for a refreshment. You've got to bring your own refreshments
just to sort of coax you along. Anyway, one of the big events, and you maybe get some comment from you, Bob, on this in a minute. This week is the death of Lord Carrington, Peter Carrington. He was the Defence Secretary under Margaret Thatcher, and he was actually Defence Secretary during the 1972 and under Heath too, under the 1972 Bloody Sunday attacks in Northern Ireland. So really, he was the guy where the buck stopped at Bloody Sunday, where I think it was 10 or 11 protesters, rather like it's just been happening over in Gaza. Protesters who were unarmed were then shot by soldiers over in Northern Ireland, which is one of those main events which actually kicked off the Troubles, which then went on to last until 1998, the Good Friday Agreement. So he was the guy who the buck stopped with on that, Peter Carrington. I haven't seen really anything about that in any of these obituaries. The other thing was, when he was a young man, he was in the Grenadier Guards in the Second World War. He was involved in the liberation of Holland, which was called Operation Market Garden, features so well actually in this film A Bridge Too Far, where they charge along a road, the army do, and the various bridges along the road over the rivers are taken by the paratroopers, the 101st Airborne, the United States, the 82nd Airborne, the United States, finally the bridge at Arnhem, which is taken by the 1st Airborne. At least they managed to cling on by their fingernails. And on Wednesday, the 22nd of September 1944, Peter Carrington was one of the first tanks, in the Grenadier Guards, to cross the Nijmegen Bridge. And I had a conversation with one of the veterans from the 101st Airborne, the 82nd Airborne, who saw him, came up to him. He said, "Well, we've taken this bridge now. Get down the road, because your guys are dying at Arnhem." And the conversation got a little bit heated, and he said, "Well, you've got to go, because we've just taken this bridge, so you can go down there and take the Rhine River, because your guys are hurting at Arnhem." And he cocked his Tommy gun, pointed it at Carrington's head, and said, "Get down that blankety blank road now, before I blow your blankety blank head off." And this was the orders of the ground troops at Arnhem were to take that bridge and hold it, but not to move forward. And after the war, there was a British colonel called Robert Kershaw. When he was over in Germany, he interviewed the Nazi commander, the SS colonel, general actually, who was in charge of the defence of Arnhem and Nijmegen during the war. And he said, "Well, the British made a mistake when they stayed in Lent, which was just over the bridge in Nijmegen. If they'd have carried on, it would have been all over for us." And so Carrington, being threatened by with a gun from the US troops to carry on, as he had a whole corps of tanks, that is to say at least 100 tanks that could have gone down that road and actually helped the British survive at Arnhem and claimed the bridgehead, almost certainly, he decided not to go. And he actually hopped into his tank, put the hatch down so that the American soldier couldn't get at him. And that was told to me directly by Moffat Burris. And you can hear that and see that up online in various places if you look him up. MoffatBurris. So that was Peter Carrington's role there. I also spoke to Major Tony Hibbert, who was actually at the bridge at the time in Arnhem. And he told me that they all thought that if those tanks had come that evening, because they decided to stop for 17 hours until the Germans had finished off the British at Arnhem Bridge, the war would have been over by Christmas. And so thank you, Peter Carrington, for your role in making sure the war didn't finish in December 1944 but carried on until May. And of course the tactic here really was to extend the war to allow the Nazis time to squirrel their money away around the world, and also to make sure that the Russians and the Soviet Union forces did the bulk of the fighting towards Berlin. And that's why they took Berlin and we didn't, because it seemed as if there was deals being done at the highest level, particularly Desmond Morton, Winston Churchill's private secretary, with the Nazi hierarchy. They wanted to take the money that the Nazis had looted from World War II and then give some of the top Nazis safe passage after the war. And they also wanted a lot of the technology, of course, including things like enriched uranium for the Nagasaki bomb. Anyway, so let's have a little listen now to a quick clip from Parliament this week from David Lidington, who's the minister in the Cabinet Office, who was sitting in for Theresa May, and also Emily Thornberry, their take on Lord Carrington.
Mr. Speaker, I have been asked to reply. My right honourable friend, the Prime Minister, is attending the NATO summit in Brussels. Mr. Speaker, I know that members from both sides of this House would like to join me in paying tribute to Lord Carrington, who died on Monday. His was an extraordinary life of public service, including as Defence Secretary, Foreign Secretary, and Secretary General of NATO.
Emily Thornberry.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I join the Minister of State in paying tribute to Lord Carrington, who served his country with such distinction in both the forces and in government, and whose decision to resign the office of Foreign Secretary will be remembered as an act of great principle and honour?
Well, that's very nice of Emily Thornberry. Also, Carrington was Secretary General of NATO. Bob, what is NATO's role these days? Because I think it was supposed to be a North Atlantic Treaty Organisation that was a defensive pact, a defensive agreement, in case the Russians rolled their tanks across Europe.
My understanding, it was developed. Yeah, it was in the times of the Cold War when the threat against sort of the West was Russia. There's an alliance of half a dozen European countries to have a military agreement, really. And Paul,
it's his role as chairman of Bilderberg, I found most irritating that wasn't included, because this was during the time of what was happening in the breakup of the former Yugoslavia, which was actually a fantastic in many ways example of how you could do socialism without it being authoritarian as the Soviet Union was. Anyway, that's all about that for now. Let's have a listen now to this. We're going to go over to Israel now. We've been hearing a lot about Gaza, a lot about the killings by the Israeli Defence Force in Gaza, probably not enough on the mainstream press about that, but the question is, why are these Israelis there? Because many, as many people have pointed out, most of them are not there for any kind of religious reason. They don't have any kind of religious faith or belief at all. But a lot of them want to take the land because God gave it to them. So what is going on?
Close to Jerusalem, the best view, the best weather, close to my parents. Yeah. Excellent. It's perfect.
These people don't own guns. They don't lock their doors. I visited 15 settlements out here in the West Bank to find out what motivates the people who are at the forefront of one of the world's most difficult and protracted conflicts. The West Bank is home to 2.2 million Arabs and seen by the international community as the part of a future Palestinian state. But there are also more than 400,000 Israeli settlers living out here, which is about 5% of Israel's population. Many of the first Jewish settlers who trekked out here in 1967 were driven by a strong ideological mission to claim this land for Israel. But things have changed quite a bit since then. Spend 10 minutes in a settlement today, and you sometimes feel that you could just as easily be in a New Jersey suburb. Clean roads, big houses, quality parks, good schools, close by shopping, a university. You ask people why they moved out here, and instead of the original mission to push forward the Israeli state, you hear things like
a very good educational system.
So this is a very nice country club.
We wanted to be able to have a bigger place.
It's a great place to raise kids.
It's just a beautiful view, and it's our beautiful land, and I love looking at it all the time.
We were looking for a Jerusalem suburb that we could afford that was a manageable commute.
Close to Jerusalem.
Extremely close to Jerusalem.
The quality of life is so much better. It has nothing to do with politics.
Having a little bit more quiet.
Most people here work in the city, and you come back here at night, you come back here in the afternoon, and it's just relaxing and quiet.
Between the puppet show for the kids, the bumpin' bar mitzvah party, and the 100 other examples of seemingly ordinary suburban life, it's hard to remember that these settlers are living at the edge of an intense conflict.
My wife and I had certain criteria. One was we wanted to walk out of our back door and be hiking in 5 minutes.
Of course, there's still ideology here. Many residents of these communities feel connected to the settlers' original mission to resettle the hills of the ancient Judean Samaria from the Bible, which they call
the cradle of our entire civilization.
Yeah. But ideological motivations for living out here are usually four or five items down the priority list, with quality of life reasons being the main drivers.
To tell you if my ideological reasons was the major motivation to move over, that wasn't one of the major things. I wasn't trying to make a statement. I was trying to find a place that would be a good place, a safe place to raise our kids, and this was the choice.
The hardcore back-to-the-earth settlers still exist. Here I am with a guy who doesn't want his name or face in my video. He lives in another outpost, illegal even to the Israeli government. There's no baseball league or bagel shops in this community.
God promised to us that this is our land and we can grow here if we listen to him.
This renegade culture of taking over hilltops once characterized the settlement movement.
If you've always felt a deep yearning for Jerusalem, now is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity not only to stand within its gates, but also to build the home of your dreams there. The tranquility of a picturesque setting and crisp mountain air with all the benefits and amenities that Jerusalem has to offer. Ramat Gibat Ze'ev is adjacent to the city of Gibat Ze'ev and is connected to Jerusalem via two main highways.
But make no mistake, there's still a conflict here, an occupation of land that has enormous impact on the lives of Palestinians.
Just, it sounds paradoxical, but this just seems like the safest place in the world.
One of the reasons why life in many settlements is so peaceful and pleasant is that the government invests proportionally more public money into the settlement communities than it does in mainland Israeli communities. Schools in the settlements receive better funding than mainland Israeli schools in the form of better salaries for teachers and other educational benefits for the kids. Nearly one-third of all subsidized housing in Israel is in the settlements, even though only 5% of Israelis live there. And in the past, the government even ran a mortgage subsidy program that made living out here much cheaper than mainland Israel. And things like public transportation are cheaper for settlers than mainland Israelis. An Israeli think tank found that the government spends about $950 on each West Bank resident. That's more than double what it spends on people living in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem.
I can't hide the quality of life that people are enjoying here, okay? I can't hide the fact that people are moving from the United States from very luxurious big homes and they choose to live in Efrat. They're managing to maintain a very similar quality of life.
On top of government support, lots of the gyms, theaters, and parks in the settlements are funded by foreign donors, usually Americans, with ideological motivations. Even these unauthorized outposts that are illegal under Israeli law enjoy a good amount of support from the government. Like this government provided soldier to protect this illegal community, or a playground that's built by the government, as well as public waste and recycling collection, all in a place that has been deemed illegal by the government. To appease the international community, the government still tries to appear tough on these unauthorized settlements. Back on that illegal outpost, my contact tells me that the authorities show up about once a year to knock down a settler's house and then take a picture of it to show the world that they don't tolerate illegal settlements. But in reality, they clearly do. The original mission of the settlement movement was to claim land deep into the West Bank, preventing a Palestinian state. Any proposal for giving Palestinians their own state now has to take into account the hundreds of thousands of Israelis living out here. No one seriously considers it possible to remove all 400,000 residents. And while negotiations are in a standstill, Israel keeps issuing permits and settlements continue to grow.
These whole peace talks are like two guys negotiating over a pizza while one of them is eating a pizza.
Just a few weeks ago, the housing minister announced that he foresees this region called Gush Etzion growing from 7,000 residents, which it is currently, to 500,000 in the next 10 years.
What did you think that I was living in? You thought I was living in some sort of tent? That I was riding camels? What did you have in your imaginary picture, the settlement movement? There are 500,000 people living here in solid homes.
Before 1996, there were 100,000 Jews living over the Green Line. Today we're approaching 500,000. And that number is just growing. Jewish people have come home. That's not going to change.
Well, that's part of a video by Johnny Harris. Excellent video, I'd say. And I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But now it's time to have a listen to Gilad Atzmon, who's got all sorts of interesting things to say about this whole idea of whether God gave secular Jews this land. What I'm asking you about, though, particularly, is how what Netanyahu does, his policies and his party and his government's policies, relates to the biblical scripture, the Old Testament, the Torah, the Talmud.
Of course. You see, in order to tackle such a question, and it is a very important question, you have to produce some background. Now, your question is very important, especially because Netanyahu doesn't look exactly like an Orthodox Jew. We don't see him with a skull cap. Many members of his government and his Likud party are not religious. In fact, his government is quite hostile to those Orthodox Jews who refuse to serve in the army. So what is happening here? In order to understand it, we have to accept the Jewish, and this is why I concentrate on the J word rather than the Z word, Zionism, Jewish identity and Jewish identification are very unique notions. So, for instance, if you are a Jew, and you decide that you don't believe in God, you're still more than welcome to consider yourself as a Jew. As we know, most of the Jews that we know around us, for sure, are secular, and they still identify as Jews. If you are a Muslim, and this is very different, and you decide that you don't believe in God, you stop being a Muslim. If you are Catholic, not believing in God, don't go to the church, you stop being a Catholic. You remain British. If you are Muslim and you don't believe in God, you're not Muslim. You are Pakistani or British or Palestinian. Jews somehow sustain their Jewish identity while not adhering to any Judaic religious concept. And here is the revelation, the notion of Jewishness is way more crucial than Judaism. We have to ask, what is it the Jews sustain even when they drop God? And this is the concept of chosenness. There is a very interesting development that happened in early Zionism when Herzl is trying to negotiate. Herzl, probably the most significant Zionist forefather, the inventor of this idea. He finds himself negotiating with different superpowers about the possibility of having a land for the Jews, a Jewish national home. And Herzl himself was quite open to many ideas like Uganda and so on and so on. And he brings this idea to the First Zionist Congress, and their reaction is very strict. They say, are you mad? They say, no, we want Palestine. He said, why do you want Palestine? They say, because this is our promised land. He said, according to who? They say, according to God. But he says, you are not religious. And the answer is, we are not religious, but it's not exactly the religion. This is what our identity is all about. So we can understand already then, in the first days of the Zionist project, that the notion of Zionism, the notion of the Jew within the Zionist context, is slightly more complicated than a strict religious belief. Now, when it comes to Benjamin Netanyahu, and to a certain extent also his foes within the Labour, their transformation of the Judaic thought is very clear. What they really did, they replaced the Talmud with the Old Testament. What do I mean by that? Judaism, the religion, Orthodox Judaism, is an adherence to the Talmud. The Talmud is very similar to the Sharia. In Islam, it's a book of laws. To be a Jew is to follow laws. Those laws are defined by the Talmud. Zionism splits the Jew from the Talmud, and it makes the Torah, the Old Testament, into the Zionist prime religious text. And this is why Israel becomes the promised land. The promised land becomes the highlight of the Zionist project. While promised land wasn't at all an issue for Orthodox Jews all along their diaspora, and we are talking about something like 1900 years. And by the way, for Orthodox Jews, Israel is still not a promised land.
Okay, so we've got a situation where the majority of the Zionists, and particularly the Likud party, these people who are governing Israel, have decided that they're really not interested. They're more secular than biblical Jews, but they still want to retain this, the idea of chosenness, which you said. But if they're chosen, who are they chosen by, if not by God?
Definitely. Listen, I'm not defending this idea. I'm not trying to say that it is rational. But I will tell you something that is slightly embarrassing. Who is the Jewish God? The Jewish God is a pretty problematic character when you think about it, yeah? When you look at the Old Testament, it's not the most ethical creature around. And you ask yourself, how can people believe in such a God? How can people believe in a God who calls them to invade another people's land and take their wells and take their land, and all the quotes are for us in Deuteronomy? And my answer is that it is actually the Jews who invented God that somehow managed to choose them over all other people. So it is the Jews who determine the nature of God rather than God that determine the nature of the Jews. And this is why the Jews are very flexible with their God. When they don't like their God after Auschwitz, they drop him. Or air, you know, now the Jewish feminist rabbis think that God is air, you know, he's a female, you know. And they drop him. And they, in fact, I argue that Judaism is just one Jewish religion amongst many. At a certain stage, communism was the new Jewish religion. And Marx, became the Messiah. And after a while, it was enlightened egotism, and Ayn Rand became the Messiah. And at a certain stage, became the new God, the neocon God, sorry. And so on and so on. And I came to realize that Jewish religion is a very flexible concept that facilitates chosenness. So if you are a Jew and you want to become a Bolshevik, it is totally fine because you are chosen. You believe yourself to be better than anyone else because you argue that everyone is equal. Obviously, it's an absurd, yeah? And neoconservatism can make you feel chosen because you believe in moral interventionism. You do it, you do all of that. You know, you're killing other people in the name of human rights and so on and so on. Basically, Coca-Cola. So I think that we are dealing with a very flexible identity that can take many shapes. And if people want to understand what it is, they have to accept that the concept that they are studying is shifting as they try to understand it.
That's Gilad Apsmon, the jazz musician. Very controversial, but anyway, he's going to be on Dialect next Tuesday at noon. A special with him, talking about all these things, particularly looking at anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. And I'm looking at putting something together in a few weeks' time, which is getting some of his detractors to get into discussion with him. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8. Coming up live on Facebook with Arabian Nights, possibly. Thanks to our guests in the first hour. That's Rich Carey, Cy Jones, Labour councillors, Paul Smith and Afzal Shah. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
For Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.